he was an unusual man. I never reappeared, and it broke my heart. Richard Park had a mantra, think number one.
Conversations, radio people in their own words, alone. Howard Hughes.
Born in Bootle in Liverpool, my first 7 years were spent not very far from Aintree Racecourse. I was surrounded by lovely people. This was real Liverpool upbringing. My dad, a policeman who'd been in the army, and we'd be out shopping. Maybe I'd be five, and we'd be walking down Stanley Road in Bootle doing our shopping, where the New Strand or the Strand Shopping Centre is now. And somebody would walk past and say, good afternoon, Mr. Hughes. And Dad would say, hi, how are you? And I'd say, Daddy, who was that? And he'd say, I locked him up, son. My mother was a secretary. She was trained in shorthand and typing. My father and my mother met at a cafe very close to the timber office, and love blossomed, and the next thing, there I was. They were loving, wonderful people. I think they would have wanted me to have a better life than they had and that their parents had. I went for a period to St. Luke's Primary School, whose main claim to fame was that their most famous pupil was Ray Moore from Radio 2.
And as 1968 seems to have been a pretty...
I failed the 11 plus. And unfortunately, I was thrown into a bin of a secondary modern school, where some, but not all, there are some living teachers there, and, you know, I think the nice ones are still alive. They didn't do these things, but some of them would see you in the corridor, think you had a bit too much to say for yourself, and slap you across the face. So awful was it that I went back to Crosby, where that school was, and stood outside while they knocked it down in more recent years, just to make sure that it was gone. Just before the Christmas holiday, we were all taken to a brand new school, and we were told that we were merging with the girls' grammar school. And I have to say that for Howard Hughes, that saved my life. The grammar school teachers took an interest in me. They saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. We had a weekend ITV, and it was called ABC. I loved ABC. ABC had pizzazz and fun. It had in-vision continuity announcers like David Hamilton and John Benson, who later became the voice of Anglia and Sail of the Century. I wanted to be them, aged three. I never had any doubt about what I wanted to do. And ABC talked about Liverpool and North Wales and stuff. And Granada tended to talk an awful lot about mill fires in Salford. And ABC talked about Blackpool, the illuminations, and fun, and the announcers were in vision. So, age three, I wanted to be David Hamilton.
Well, at 4:45, we get more sharpshooting, only with less blood this time, when the golden shot returns in the hands of Bob Monkhouse.
I was very shy as a kid. I would not say boo to a goose. But I made a demo tape to send to David Jensen, Kid Jensen's disc jockey contest, organised by Scotch Cassettes. And I was too shy to send it in because I thought it was awful and didn't send it. And my mother, God bless my wonderful mum, when Radio City came on air and announced this disc jockey contest, she said, you've got to send the tape that you made for David Jensen's Search for a DJ contest to Radio City. And bearing in mind, self-belief has not really been a big thing for me. I should have had more of it and never really did. Bearing in mind, I didn't want to send the tape in because I didn't want to lose, did I? But nobody was more gobsmacked than me when I got a handwritten letter from Alan Bleasdale's producer telling me that I'd won and making me an appointment to come to the studios of Radio City in Stanley Street, Liverpool, and do my 15 minutes.
Well, a good morning to you. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is the Million Dollar Sound of 194 Radio City. Before I go any further, I'd like to say a big hello to all of the members of the Lower Six at Chesterfield High School in Crosby, and also to Beryl and Ray Jones of Ranelagh Drive in Birkdale. For you, here's a fine record.
At school, when that thing aired, suddenly people started thinking, this quiet person, who wouldn't say boo to a goose, who's rather shy around the girls and stuff, this is what he's going to do. We'd better be nice to him. That's how it happened. At school, I was then sending out demo tapes to stations like Piccadilly and Metro. They both took an interest in me, as did Radio City. In Liverpool, I was getting into what they used to call DXing, long-distance radio listening. And I started with AFN, the American Forces Network, which used to run Casey Kasem's American Top 40. Hi, this is Casey Kasem here, and we're counting them down. So I loved that.
Casey's Coast to Coast American Top 40.
Two to go, and the countdown continues.
Number two.
I call them the mini Temptations because when they're on stage, they are as flashy as the Temptations are today.
And then I started to try and DX out commercial stations, so I was the only person, I think, in Crosby listening to Radio Tees and Beacon Radio from Wolverhampton. Those were my influences. I started to formulate ideas of people I wanted to be like. I remember my dad, when he retired from the police, because they retire them young from the police, so he got himself a job running regional security for Comet, the electrical discount warehouse, and he used to take me down to his headquarters in Birmingham, and we'd listen to BRMB, and I'd sit there recording BRMB, and I was a big fan of a man called George Ferguson. You know, George Ferguson was a star, but should have been a mega star. He was on BRMB and Beacon. George Ferguson was a hero, but then my parents took me on holiday to Deal, and we drove across London, and we listened on the car radio to Capital Radio. And I'd never heard it before, of course I hadn't. And I had my first cassette recorder and a radio connected to it. And I recorded, and I've got the recording somewhere here, David Simons on Capital Radio. And suddenly a big penny dropped. I want to be like David Simons, who you've had on this show. And his edition was wonderful. His edition brought me to tears. It was a marvellous, marvellous interview. So David Simons became the person I wanted to be like. So when I was making my demo tapes, I'd heard David say on the Capital Countdown, "Well, a good morning to you." So I started saying, "Well, a good morning to you. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is whatever it might be," on those demo tapes. I tried to be like, of course, you shouldn't try to be like anybody, really.
Is a Capital calibrated climber.
Well, I've been told that Michelle Godfrey is 24 today. It's lots of love to you from Roger Miller. Well, dang me. The Capital calibrated climber from Don Everly.
University happened next, thanks to my wonderful teachers and me actually getting those A-levels that they thought I'd get. Before that, I had done a little bit of, just a week of work experience at Piccadilly in Manchester. Piccadilly, of course, was pretty much an instant hit, I think. And I'd sent a demo tape to Piccadilly, and I hadn't got any jingles to use on it. So I found some jingles that were from wonderful Radio London, the pop pirate ship, some Pam's jingles, and I used them. And then I got a call from Piccadilly saying that Colin Walters had your tape on. Colin Walters was the programme controller. He had the tape on in his office, and Philip T. Birch, the managing director of Piccadilly, who had run wonderful Radio London, had heard that and said, "Isn't that nice that this young man remembers Radio London?" Which, of course, I didn't. I'd never heard.
Wonderful Radio London.
And that's how I ended up with a week of work experience at Piccadilly. So I had a choice to make. The choice was I going to be a disc jockey, which I could have been, or was I going to concentrate on getting the degree? And I really came to the conclusion that getting the degree that nobody in my family had ever dreamt of was much more important than being a disc jockey. Part of this connects with the difference at the time between Radio City and Piccadilly. Piccadilly, I think, was more targeted at Radio 1. And their slogan became "First with the music, first with the news."
If you try to pick up a few key words that would describe Piccadilly Radio, which I think is what you're doing, is friendliness I would put first, happy station I would put second, an informative one third.
Radio City was run by journos, people who'd worked on newspapers. It was founded by Terry Smith. You know, David Maker, program controller, ex-newspaper. They were all newspaper people. So they valued news, I think, more, perhaps, than they valued the other side of things. News was sacrosanct and paramount at Radio City. That's not to say that the DJ programs were not excellent, because they were. They were national class. Bill Bingham was on air there for a time. Great little Graham Dean. You'd hate me for saying that. Tarrant used to call him, "Oh, it's little Graham Dean." Graham Dean was on Radio City before he moved to Capital. He went straight from City to Capital.
21 minutes now before 8 o'clock. And if you're going off to school, and maybe you've got a few minutes before you have to catch the bus, well, hang on just a moment, because what I'd like to know is...
So Radio City was news-based. And their view was that any young man with a degree should really be a news person. In my heart, really, I wanted to play records, but Radio City were very keen on the news, and they were my local station. And I ended up... I tell you what happened. It's all coming back now through the mist of time. I mean, Radio City had great DJ programs. People like John Jason were on there. He did Downtown and The Peaceful Hour, which is famous in the northwest of England, which I later came to do when I filled in for the great Pete Price. I did The Peaceful Hour too, years and years later. Radio City invited me to come in after I'd auditioned, aged 19 or 20, when I was still at uni, for Morning Merseyside, the breakfast show on BBC Radio Merseyside. Now, I was never, ever going to be a BBC local radio person, and I think that's shone throughout my career. But the boss of Radio Merseyside, Roy Corlett, who later went on to run, I think he run Lincolnshire and Devon, didn't forget me from the audition, and he passed my name on to Roger Wilkes, ex-BBC man, who was the news editor at Radio City. That's how I got a call from Radio City inviting me in one morning. So at breakfast, I think who was on duty then? Paul Rowley was on duty, and a guy who later went on to produce Alistair Cook's Letter from America, Tony Grant, was there. And Tony was in the process of leaving for London. And Tony had a great voice, and they wanted to try and replace Tony. Well, I didn't have a voice like Tony's, not then. And they said, OK, will you do us a favour? Go into the news booth after Tony's read the news. This was, you know, 8:05 in the morning. And read this script. And they gave me the news that Tony just read. And I came out of the news booth and they said, you sound like you've been doing that all your life. So I sort of was very lucky, aged 19 or 20. Radio City had me earmarked to work in the newsroom. Radio City came up with the idea of a graduate trainee scheme, and I was the first trainee. They were making so much money that they had to either give away a lot of their profits to the IBA in secondary rental, the Independent Broadcasting Authority, or spend it on good projects like equipment and staff training. So they came up with the idea. First of all, they thought Howard Hughes can just read the news. And then they thought, well, nobody these days is just a reader of news. We'll teach him how to be a journalist, which I've never really wanted to be. But, you know, I wasn't going to tell them that. So they sent me away to Cardiff University as part of being hired by Radio City. I was a trainee and I had to do the 1 year journalism diploma at University College Cardiff, which people were climbing all over themselves to get into. But I got myself a bought place, a paid for place on that course. Wasn't I lucky again? And I had training from wonderful Fleet Street journalists, people who'd been stars on national newspapers. And they taught me the disciplines of writing for newspapers for 6 months before I did radio training. And most of the stuff I learned about radio, I learned at Radio City. The stuff I learned about journalism and writing, I was taught by people like Norman Katanak, who'd been on national newspapers, and Val Williams, and a guy who used to run a magazine in the 50s called Picture Post, who was the overall head of it all. So I had a wonderful training, all free. I see it as an absolutely magical place. Anybody who knew it would know that the reception area had a smell to it. It was unique. If I was to smell that smell now, I'd get butterflies and feel nervous and excited. I first went in there, I remember, on a Saturday. I used to get pocket money, and I used to take a bus ride, the L3, into Liverpool. And I would mooch around the place, go up the tower, the St. John's Tower, which is now the Radio City Tower. It was a tourist attraction, so you could spend 20 pence and go up the tower and have a cup of soup at the top and then go home. That was my pocket money. One day, my moochings took me to Stanley Street and Radio City, and the door was open. It was a Saturday. There was nobody on reception, so I I walked up a spiral staircase and into the newsroom, where years later I would come to work. And there were people with cigarettes on the go, typewriters clacking away. They were doing the sports show. And a man that I later came to realise was David Maker, who was the boss of Radio City at that time, said, what are you doing in here, son? I said, I'm sorry, I was looking for a car sticker. And he said, we'll get you some car stickers. How did you get in here? I said, I'm sorry, I walked up the stairs. He said, well, that's all right, but there are some car stickers, and, you know, on your way, son. So that was my first experience of Radio City. It was an enormous radio station. Radio City had a problem at the beginning. Its AM transmitter was the only one that was ready and functioning when they launched, so they did not have FM. FM came 6 months later. So they were a slow burner. At the beginning, people were not listening. It took off. It took off like a firework, especially after they got FM. Radio City was at the heart of so much in Liverpool. It was just in with the bricks as part of the community. Anything important was on Radio City, and if you were on Radio City, everybody knew you, which was an astonishing thing. So my impression of Radio City was that it was just big, and I think Gillian Reynolds at the beginning had wanted it to be like Capital. So a lot of the things that were, I'd see it and hear at Capital, I'd see and hear at Radio City. It was a similar in those days kind of style, right down to the fact that the main presentation mic at Radio City was a Neumann U47. Very expensive microphone, which has a signature sound. That was the signature sound of Radio City and was also the signature sound of Capital. And over at Piccadilly down the road, they used AKG 202s like the BBC did.
I lived in Liverpool and I came to London to see the people at LBC and to see the people at Capital. Michael Bucht was so supportive to me.
Unfortunately, I've always had a bit of a restless streak. I wanted to play records still. So I ended up, after going to Brighton, visiting Brighton one day on holiday, I ended up joining the BBC. And Roger, I remember his reaction when I told him that I was leaving my staff job, and the shining path was there for me. You know, it was the yellow brick road was there for Howard. You know, I could have been anything I wanted to be, but no, I wanted to play records and do other stuff, and I rather liked the idea of living by the sea in Brighton and discovering other things. So I told him, and he said, I won't rehearse the list of expletives, but he said that you're mad. He said it's not even effing Radio Humberside, it's BBC Brighton. What have you done this for? And I have to say, Roger, you were right.
The coastal sound on Radio Brighton.
You know, it was quite a nice experience working for BBC local radio at the beginning and living in a flat in Norfolk Square in Brighton by the sea. It was a big adventure for me. I was terribly naive, though. I didn't realise that there would be some people who would see me as some outsider from commercial radio, and worse, possibly from Liverpool, who'd been brought in by the station manager. I did everything. I was a station assistant. I played records on the air, did the drive time show, which was, I did On Our Way. And I was befriended by a man called Vince Geddes, who later went on to run Southern Sound. And Vince was a good friend to me. But my memory of Vince was that I was deputed to help out at an outside broadcast from the South of England show at Ardingly. And they were broadcasting from an old caravan that had obviously been some family's old battered caravan. And they had a couple of turntables with slip mats, you remember these, an audio developments mixer, and a pair of headphones, and that was it. Vince was at the time, the oldest station assistant in BBC local radio. And he went down there to present On Our Way from Ardingly, took a look at the caravan, the technical setup, the knee-deep mud in the field, and said, I hope you don't mind me telling this story, Vince. It's a long time ago, and you're a wonderful man. He said, I'm not doing that. And he went back to Brighton. So the boss said, boss spoke like this. He said, Howard, Vince is coming back here, so we want you to do the drive-time show. Is that all right? I had a blast. One of the other nice things I did a live outside broadcast from a glider. It was only when we landed at Lewis Airfield that somebody came up and said, you know that you've just broken Civil Aviation Authority rules for transmissions from gliders, but too late, we'd been on the air. So BBC Local Radio was fun from that point of view, but the truth of it was I was never going to be a BBC local radio person, a guy who later went on to Radio 4 called Robin. I remember once in the studio he said, you don't make mistakes. That's not the phrase he used. You don't make mistakes, so that's good, he said. But I don't like the noises you make. In other words, he didn't like the way that I spoke. All the books used to say, to get on in broadcasting, you have to have a neutral accent. So I was a big World Service listener. And as you might recall, the newsreaders on BBC World Service were terribly, there was a man called John Wing, beautiful, big, deep voice, and terribly posh.
BBC World Service. Saudi Arabia says its troops have regained control of the Grand Mosque in Mecca.
So I thought it might be a good idea to be like them. So to get here, where I really don't care anymore, and this is just me, but to get here, I had to go through a period of being big, posh announcer for a while. And I think there's a little bit of everything in there now. I was massively influenced by American announcers. I loved them. When I was a kid, there were lots of programs on TV that had announcers at the beginning. So they would say, The Streets of San Francisco, a Quinn Martin production.
The Streets of San Francisco, a Quinn Martin production.
And I ended up leaving BBC Local Radio. I'm in the wilderness, aren't I? I went back to live with my parents, and Radio City were not, you know, beating down the door to have me back. And I don't, actually, I don't blame Roger for not beating the door down. So I was having to try and make my own way in the world. I was out of it all for a period. Then I went to get some noodles and beef at a place called Hippo's Diner in Formby, near where my parents lived. And they had on Radio Nova from Dublin, a big pirate station. And they were asking for newsreaders. No, I didn't realise that Chris Carey, who ran Radio Nova, had just fired the entire news team because they were NUJ. He was in dispute with them. So I sent him a tape. He phoned the next day, and I was on a boat to Dublin a day after that. So I ended up, not for very long, for one summer, working on pirate radio in Dublin with some truly amazing people. I mean, people who've been on pirate boats like Tony Allen and people like that. The radio station sounded like an American radio station. Radio City were going crazy in Liverpool because this station was booming into Liverpool, even carrying ads for Liverpool businesses at one time. They had an office in Liverpool, like Radio Caroline had had years before.
Current single from Hazel O'Connor, We're All Grown Up. Radio Nova International, with the time's exactly 4 o'clock. I'm Hugh O'Brien, and if you are at Slane Castle tomorrow afternoon, you'll see Hazel O'Connor. And of course, you will also see
So,
this
you know, then I came back to Liverpool to my parents, and for a short time went out to the Voice of Peace, which was a pop pirate ship anchored off Tel Aviv.
From somewhere in the Mediterranean, peace, love, and good music.
They employed Western DJs, guys from Canada, US, Australia, UK. The mantra was peace. So I played records on that for a very short time. That was another great life experience. Then I left the Voice of Peace, came back to the UK, and started to try to set up a community radio station in Southport. So I got myself featured in the Liverpool Echo, as ex-Radio City's Howard Hughes has got this idea. And they described me as a clean-cut young man with clear-cut ideas. Never forgotten that. I got the backing of local MPs and local businesses who were going to put money in. I costed transmitters, studio equipment, and we were good to go, pretty much. Only trouble is the government decided to pull the plug on the idea of community radio, so I was stuck again. And then I found Radio Wyvern, working for wonderful Norman Bilton. But for some reason, he had me down to Worcester, so I drove my little old VW Beetle down to Barbourne Terrace in Worcester. Thought how lovely the area was. And the radio station was based in this big old house that the composer Elgar had lived in. But he had lived everywhere. He was a character who had had many homes around Worcestershire. And I went in there and met Norman Bilton. And I think I remember saying to Norman, give me 7 days and I'll show you that you need me. I don't know where that came from. But I needed the gig. I needed work. And they hired me. So a few days later, I was moving down the motorway again with a sleeping bag, a bowl, a plate, a knife, a fork, a radio, of course, and some clothes. So I ended up renting a little place, a little single room. And that was the beginning of an adventure. I worked virtually 7 days a week at Radio Wyvern. I did the news. The phrase Howard Hughes, Wyvern News, became, they tell me, became part of Wyvern's history. I did every show on the station, including breakfast. I did a talk show called Personal Choice, where we'd have important people like the cricketer, the late Graham Dilley. This was the way commercial radio worked in those days. I also had a phone-in for a brief while. They gave me Howard's Hotline, which was a phone-in with no delay. I've never come across a station like Wyvern. It had such a unique connection with the audience.
But Mark, have a good day. Anybody you'd like to say hello to quickly?
Anybody that knows me.
Oh, that's nice and short and sweet. Thanks, Mark. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Mark Hornby calling from Hereford and getting it wrong, unfortunately.
Part of my job on the breakfast shift on news was to sort the post every morning. And there would be a ton of mail, postcards, letters. There was no email in those days, from people who loved the station and wanted to get a mention, maybe come in and visit. I did the only November the 5th firework disco in a farmer's field in Evesham of my life. Can you imagine me doing a disco? I just drank it in. I was very lucky. Sammy Southall. Sammy was first DJ on the air, and he was senior jock at Radio Wyvern.
Well, welcome along to Wyvern. What more can I say? It's great to be here at long last.
Sammy befriended me. He's still a friend to this day. On my first weekend there, he took me for a tour of the county. We stood on top of the Malvern Hills, and we looked down from their beautiful place. I later went to live in Malvern. And we looked down into Herefordshire. And he said, OK, Howard, what do you see? I said, what do you mean? He said, what do you see? I said, well, fields and sheep. He said, exactly, sheep. No fucking people, but sheep. So, he said, that's our problem. Norman's background was in sales. He was an unusual man. He had routines. For example, Norman only ever drove a Ford Capri. I think he had two or three of them while I was there, which was the archetypal rep's car, of course. The Ford, he loved the Ford Capri. He even had one of the last ever Ford Capris made. On Sunday, Norman and his wife and secretary Stephanie would come in to check the mail and check the radio station. And if you were there on a Sunday, you'd see Norman arrive and he'd always be wearing the same thing. He'd have a sort of cream-coloured woolly pullover and a shirt underneath with the collar up, right? That was Norman's look. And that was Norman's look on a Sunday, which was not Norman's look Monday to Saturday, which was always a suit and tie. And he was not Norman. Terry Smith at Radio City was Terry. Norman was Mr. Bilton. And he remained Mr. Bilton until well after I'd left the radio station. He was amazing. I'll give you one example of how astute Norman was. I was, again, terribly shy, and I hated appearing in front of people. A bizarre thing for somebody who does this for a living to say. But he wanted to bring me out of myself. So he came up with the idea of sending me to Hereford Market. And he told people on the air, they told people on the air, Howard Hughes is doing the Drive Time show this afternoon. This morning you will see him at Hereford Market. If you see him, please say to him, I believe you're Howard Hughes from Radio Wyvern, and I claim my prize. Right? It was a wonderful experience. I met the entire Hereford United football team who were jogging around the market. I got a chance to go on a market stall and sell things for half an hour. That was great. And it brought me out of myself.
Yeah, the Wyvern weather check, a rather cloudy morning with showery rain, heavy in parts, but with an improvement to sunshine and only scattered heavy showers in the afternoon.
I always had itchy feet, and I wanted to try and get to London. And if I couldn't get to London, then I wanted to get to somewhere that was near London. So I went to County Sound. I sent a tape to Mike Powell. It was another one of my heroes. He's on my heroes list. They didn't want me to go at Wyvern. There were tears in the studio. I remember the cleaner came in on my last Drive Time show at Wyvern. December the 24th, it was Christmas Eve. And part of me didn't want to leave Worcestershire because I'd been so happy there. But part of me realised I had to move on and I had to move upwards or laterally or whatever I was doing. I wanted to get to London. So that was a big emotional thing. And then come the new year, I started at County Sound, which was a totally different station. County Sound Radio in Guildford was at the time the only radio station to be totally overlapped by competitors from London. I believe that was the state of play for its first few years. And the station was like a mix of Radio 1 and Radio 2. It had expensive American jingles, County Sound Radio, a lot of technology that we certainly couldn't afford at Wyvern. And Mike Powell, I had tons of time for. We had the first selector for music with a colour screen. So that was a good place. Unfortunately, though, I'd been there for 6 months and the phone went. And it was Norman Bilton. And Norman used the phrase that I've never heard before or since. He said, Howard, can you help me? I'm a man down. So the news editor's just quit. Can you come back and help us? And because I felt such a sense of loyalty to Norman, I quit County Sound, where I was, again, very happy in Guildford. And I went back to Wyvern and was news editor for a while. And I didn't really feel that I wanted to be a news editor. You know, we had the BBC coming along and I would have to compete on just myself and one or two other people against the BBC. And I just thought I want to do other things. And I've given Norman 6 months, so I want to move on. And I started looking. I got myself offered two gigs. And I think, again, I can tell this story now. And, you know, Ralph Bernard is a friend, so I don't think he'll mind. But I was offered Bath breakfast on GWR, playing records, like I'd always wanted, or a general job at Ocean down in Fareham. And I was going to go to GWR because I was an admirer of GWR. I used to go home from Wyvern and listen to GWR. Dave Bassett on the phone in, and Johnny Walker in those days. So I wanted to be a GWR person. But I got a phone call a night for about 3 nights from Michael Betton, the program controller of Ocean, to say, you're not going to be able to do anything much at GWR. Come to us. Anyway, I like Mike a lot. And so I ended up going down to Ocean and helping to launch. They were splitting four ways. If you can imagine, four radio stations in one building. So they had a service for Portsmouth, a service for Southampton, a service out of Winchester that played light music, and they were launching Power FM 103.2, which was going to be like Radio 1 on steroids. And they hired Pete Wardman, who's a fantastic disc jockey and a great broadcaster in the East Midlands these days. And Pete, if you're hearing this, you know, I was a huge admirer, always have been, of what you did there.
Britain's newest commercial music station, broadcasting across the South on 103.2 FM.
And we launched Power FM December the 4th, it was just before Christmas, and I was first on air there. The remit was something that had never been done, I think, in the UK before. It was to do a news service in 80 seconds, and 10 seconds of the 90 seconds was the jingle that resolved to the top of the hour. So it was just before the top of the hour. So I did this zappy, pappy news service for Power FM. But then my shift would finish at 10 o'clock. I'd do the breakfast news on Power FM, and I'd have to calm down the corridor and onto the Light FM, playing old Radio 2-style light music, which I absolutely detested. That was part of my gig. And on Saturdays, I would do a show across all the Ocean stations, more modern music. And that show got listener response. But just as they got listener response for it, they changed it to a Light FM music style, and all of the postcards and letters and response died overnight. And I remember them telling me, and it's a long time ago, and I think it's okay to say now, that I was being paid £3 a shift less than their staff journalist. And they asked me not to tell the staff journalist because they'd have a dispute on their hands. I did my year there or so and ended up moving to BRMB. But before I went to BRMB, I'd had a meeting with Robin Malcolm, who ran LBC. I loved LBC. LBC was where I really wanted to be. I wanted to do talk shows or news there or anything, really. In those days, LBC was only for London. It was a London thing, London Broadcasting Company. So I had this meeting with Robin Malcolm, and I didn't think anything was going to come of it, so I went ahead and took the job at BRMB. 3 months into the job at BRMB, at the Alpha Tower in Aston, which coincidentally was the Birmingham headquarters of ABC Television, then I got a phone call from John Perkins, who is one of my absolute heroes, probably the ultimate radio hero, the managing director of IRN, which was part of LBC. And he said, Howard, we're ceasing to use news readers and we're hiring reader writers. We'd like you to do an audition first. Okay, well, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound. Let's go down to London, do the audition. And my girlfriend, Karen, at the time, was massively supportive. I mean, supportive. She moved me to Birmingham. One Sunday, boiling hot day, we piled down the motorway to Gough Square, Communications House, LBC IRN. And I was nearly sick with fear, nerves. I thought I couldn't do it. I thought, I can't do this audition. This is too big for me. And outside, a man called Rick Thomas, who was one of the editors of IRN, as it was. There was no chance of going back on it then. I went in. There were, I think, 8 or 10 of us all auditioning that day for a number of roles. And I wrote a bulletin from PA copy. Sat there, and they played the then LBC theme, the one that took you to the top of the hour, da, 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 which Radio Solent later used. Da, 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 like that. I mean, yeah, it's a wonderful theme. And I got a shot of cold running right down my spine. And it just inspired me. I heard the woman's voice say, 11:52 a.m., 97.3 VHF FM, this is LBC.
97.3 FM stereo, LBC radio.
Da, 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 da. And I said the words, the 9 o'clock news, this is Howard Hughes. And I read a bulletin, certainly nervous during it, that they later told me came out at a perfect 3 minutes. I hadn't timed it.
It's 12 o'clock. This is Douglas Cameron. The number of people out of work now looks likely to rise more sharply than at any time since the depression of the 1930s. Financial editor Douglas...
I had a problem talking with Douglas Cameron. I could barely speak around him because he was my hero. He was the doyen of reading the news. And if Douglas would come in at 5:30 to pick up his script from the IRN desk, preparing to go and present on LBC, sometimes he'd turn to me and say, Howard, I heard you at 5 o'clock. You're in very good voice. My day would shine from then on in. People I came to know were the late Mike Dickin, who for my money was the finest speech broadcaster we've ever had. You know, Mike was a tough guy on air. People would say, hello, Mike, how are you? And he'd say, the state of my health is not in question. which was something he did for years on TalkSport and LBC. You may be aware of Mike Allen, an absolute capital legend who became a talk presenter on LBC and had a voice like a lot of the capital jocks had in the 80s. So, you know, there was this sort of voice like this. It was all a sort of derivative of Roger Scott. John Sachs sounded a bit like that. And Mike Allen. Hello, this is Mike Allen here. It's LBC, 353-8111. Give me a call.
The liberation of Kuwait has begun. In conjunction with the forces of our coalition partners, the United States has moved under the code name Operation Desert Storm.
Situations have a habit of finding me, and the Gulf War broke out on a night that I was doing a night shift with my writing partner. There were two of us on every shift, the reader-writer and the bulletin editor, Anne Busby. We had a bulletin ready for that 1 o'clock. I had to throw it in the bin. We had to start again. We had 5 minutes to do it. And I said, what am I going to say at the top of this bulletin? And we sat for a second and we thought, hang on. And she said, it's war in the Gulf. That was the top line.
The 2 o'clock news, this is Howard Hughes. The Gulf War is on. Waves of American and British fighters and bombers have been pounding Baghdad and military targets inside Iraq. The attacks started around midnight.
I just had to make it up as I went on from there. She was bringing in copy and cuts. We did that bulletin, and then at 3 o'clock in the morning, we did what I think is the longest bulletin that IRN had ever done to the network, 15 minutes, including a live cross to the White House on a clock start. LBC IRN at Gough Square had a tremendous vibe in those days. It was a cast of characters. I can remember at one point, Peter Dealey was printing out scripts for his show. And one of my colleagues was wanting to print out the scripts for the IRN news, which always took precedence. So this person ran to the printer, elbowing Peter Dealey out the way. A filing cabinet collapses on top of the woman who was doing financial news. And John Perkins comes out of his office, a wonderful man. John Perkins allowed us to be adults. He didn't micromanage. He was the best boss possible. And I remember his phrase, seeing the carnage in front of him. He just said, and I quote, it's all part of the creative frisson. That's my happiest. And the other happy memory from Gough Square was monitoring Radio 1. We used to monitor Radio 1 news, and there was a song in the chart called Birdhouse in Your Soul by They Might Be Giants. Put a little birdhouse in your soul. My happy memory that I will take to my grave of working at Gough Square was the entire news shift of IRN standing up and dancing. Make a little birdhouse in your soul. Into every perfect life, a little rain must fall. And I can look on it philosophically now, and it's all my fault anyway. I did it. I decided to leave IRN, and I decided that I wanted to present talk shows. And I wasn't going to get that for a long time, if ever, at LBC. So I answered an ad for a breakfast presenter at BBC Berkshire. I went to the Portman Road in Reading, met Simon Major, very nice man running the station. I don't think I even wanted the job particularly, but I got it. I passed the audition. And then I started thinking, well, Howard, look, you get into the BBC, you get into Five Live. You might get onto Radio 4. You know, there's a whole world of possibility there, Howie. Why don't you do it? And I accepted the gig.
Good morning and welcome. I'm Howard Hughes. You're listening to Berkshire Today. It's Tuesday, January the 21st, 1992, and the time is 6:30.
And I have to say, although there were lovely people there, like Simon was a nice man, but I don't think being a local radio manager was his thing. I don't think, maybe I'm wrong, and Simon, I'm sorry if I am. I don't think he was cut out for that necessarily. But they had completely, and I think I'm allowed to say this, completely, utterly, totally the wrong idea of how to run a station for Berkshire, for the Thames Valley. They aimed it all at the rural community, but they should have concentrated more on Slough, the London fringes, Basingstoke, big town. And I think that was a massive mistake. That's why nobody listened. The Windsor transmitter was on 95.4, and it was drowning out capital for people in Windsor who wanted to hear Chris Tarrant. They didn't want to hear me. It was not a happy year for me on any level. And thanks to Karen, my girlfriend at the time, we, at the end of the first year, planned my escape at a restaurant in Portsmouth on the back of a napkin. I did shifts at the FBS, you know, reading the news to Belize and Hong Kong, places like that. I was taught to read the news on BFBS by a Radio 2 guy called Don Durbridge, who I'd listened to as a kid, who had this most fantastic voice.
The telephone lines are now open, and the number, assuming you're dialing outside of London, 01 is the prefix, and then it's 580-4411.
But I was doing shifts everywhere. One night I finished a shift at Network News, drove through the night to do a shift on Power FM at Ocean. I was awake for 24 hours that day, and I loved it. I just thought, I'm free from Radio Berkshire. I was happy being back in commercial radio. Then one morning, I was driving home on an icy morning, stuck on the A40, going back out to Bracknell. I'd done an overnight shift at BFBS, and I turned on the radio. And for some reason, I didn't listen to LBC that day. I'd listened to Capital, and I'd never listened to Chris Tarrant before.
The weather cloudy with heavy outbreaks of rain for most of the morning, but it's going to clear up sometime after lunch with one or two showers. Oh, I see, so it's not going to rain quite as much.
And I thought, this is so well produced, I want to be part of this. I didn't think any more of it, but I did send them a tape. 12 weeks later, I was doing it. I was on that breakfast show. I remember thinking at the time, it would be great to be on that show, because what a shop window for you that is. Think of how many people would get to hear you. It's a little voice inside. So I went to Capital to do a test shift with Simon Weiger, my mate Simon Weiger, who I'd known at Ocean. And they let me write the news and read the news live all afternoon at the Euston Tower as my audition. And I met people who I'd heard on radio, like David Jensen. I teamed up again with Neil Fox, of course, who I'd worked with at Wyvern. And at the end of the shift, I'm putting my coat on. I'm thinking, I wonder what that was all about. And Nick Wheeler, who was the head of news, who later became a great friend, said to me, well, do you want the job?
Oh, yeah.
He said, breakfast news with Tarrant, 3 months for starters. So I put my coat on this freezing day at the Euston Tower, gobsmacked.
Tearing in the morning.
And I took the job.
95.8. Capital FM.
Capital was sex and drugs and rock and roll without the sex and drugs. No, it was everything amplified to the max. It was a wonderful place. Richard Park had a mantra that we all worked to, and that was think number one. And so we did. It was almost like a psychological thing. At Capital, you were number one. You had to think number one, then you would be number one. I used to do interviews for The Way It Is, The Way It Is, which was their sort of newsbeat program. The Way It Is on 95.8 Capital FM. And I would get to meet some of my heroes. I interviewed Paul Carrack, a musician's musician, top guy. Miss Piggy. I had a confrontation with Miss Piggy. I did an interview with Miss Piggy from The Muppets. And Frank Oz, was it, came in. He said, the way that we do this is that Miss Piggy comes in a zip bag. Have a look at Miss Piggy. Touch Miss Piggy, it's okay. And then I'm going to put her away. And then when we do the interview, you're going to look away from me. And that's what we did. And the interview went beautifully until the point where I suggested that perhaps Miss Piggy had had some facelifting or snout lifting work done to be the megastar that she'd been. And she looked at me, she said, what do you mean, Howard? And the interview ended.
I don't like the way that you're raising that trotter.
I'm not going to do anything to you if you're going to be nice to me from now on.
Okay, I promise to be nice.
Fine.
Can I just finally...
It's too late!
Happy, happy days. And then, of course, there was Chris Tarrant. He was wonderful. For years, he was like my brother, really. We had similar senses of humour. I think in some ways we're similar people, only divided by the fact that I was poor and remain poor, and he was a multimillionaire. Apart from that, if you leave that factor out, then we were very close. I remember our first encounter on air, and Sandy Waugh, who'd done Breakfast News before me, hello, Sandy. Sandy said, you've got to be ready for the fact that he takes the proverbial out of everybody. He will find your Achilles heel, and he will work it mercilessly, which he did. First encounter, I thought, okay, attack is the best form of defence. The last news story on the news headlines at 7:30, my first encounter with Chris, were about a poll of the most boring people in the UK. At the end of it, I said, oh, I thought, OK, here we go. I wonder how this is going to go. So I thought, I'll give him something to work with. And I said, strange there are no disc jockeys on this list, Chris. He looked at me across the desk with half a smile, and he said, well, you're not going to last very long here. And that was us. I had three rocky months where I was saying the wrong things. You know, when you're working in a double act, well, it's not a double act, it's a zoo format. I was just a small part of it. No double act. When you're working as somebody who's being addressed by a big star, you have to know how to come back. And sometimes I would say things that were not right or that were not very good, that were not funny. So for the first 3 months, it was touch and go. I kept believing that Richard Park was imminently going to fire me. And then after 3 months or so, and I'd had a kind of bollocking from Nick Wheeler, we had a row, and then we ended up big friends after that. It was like a turning point. Everything seemed to click. Then Cara Noble left and went to work for Heart, and then there was a scandal over a photograph. Cara was very successful on the show, but I think she wanted to present her own shows, and Chrysalis, they offered her the chance to do that. So Cara, who's a great friend, now lives in Los Angeles, went to do that. Then they had a problem. The problem was, who is going to be Cara? And here's a story that everybody will have forgotten, but they hired a replacement for Cara, a woman called Zabby, short for Elizabeth, who I liked enormously, but I think with the best will in the world, had no idea what you should go on the radio and say. Now, unfortunately, Zabby was very glamorous, so they gave her a launch down the Busby Barclay staircase at the Euston Tower and invited the press. Sadly, Zabby lasted 3 months. So they said to me, would you like to go on the outside broadcast and be more of a part of it? I said, yes, please. I said, okay, this is a bit of a test. We're going to bring you to Hawaii. Worked my socks off doing features and pieces and, you know, trying to be as funny as I could be. And Chris Tarrant was saying, he said, how are you interviewing more women? For God's sake, you're using your microphone as an extension to your appendage. All words to that effect. We had a great time. And on the way back, they turned to me, Annie, the producer, turned to me and she said, you're on the away team now. And that was it. I went all around the world with Chris.
I'm standing here on a rock with one of the best views of Cape Town, Russ Kane.
Yes.
One of the best views I've ever had. Oh, my God, I had a fall up the rock. Bit of a breeze up the trouser leg there, but never mind. You know,
you're very nimble, aren't you? That's
very nimble on my feet.
Person. Great gangling fool. I'm
standing.
You're trying
here.
To stand there.
I'm still standing.
Yes.
If I like realised that it was a phenomenon that I think the show was, I probably have asked not to be paid a staff journalist's salary, and I probably have asked for more money because I came out of it relatively poor. But that was because I was just loving what I was doing. The way I look on it, though, is that the person who was on air then doing the news was a sort of creation, I think. It wasn't entirely me. It was somebody that I made for that, because they told me when I first joined, you've got to speak quickly and you've got to be snappy. So I made this person who was 10 times faster than I was ever on IRN and grew into that mold. I was still shy. I remember I had to present an award in my second year, a Help a London Child Award. You know, I nearly had a severe attack of diarrhea before that thing. I was so scared. And by watching Chris Tarrant, by the end of my time at Capital, I learned how to go onto the stage at Hyde Park in front of 100,000 people.
It's exactly 9:30 news. I'm half hour on 95.8 Capital FM.
I'm Howard Hughes. Scotland Yard is trying to trace a mystery caller who tipped off detectives a man's body was in a Shepherd's Bush flat. Police think the victim in his 30s had been strangled at the flat in Woodstock Grove. A social
it
worker.
It reached an endpoint when, after I'd done 9 years, and Chris announced one morning to us that he was doing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire then. He was working very hard and didn't need the money then. So he said to us, I've decided I'm going to leave. You've all got to make a plan. I don't think this has ever been told before, but that's what he told us. He said, well, you've all got to make a plan. You're on your own, was the words, after next year. So I thought, okay. Richard Parr had left Capital. It wasn't quite the same place. They'd started to try and be more like Kiss. I don't think it worked. You know, Kiss is Kiss. Radio 1 is Radio 1, and Capital was Capital. But they were aware of the fact that the audience demographic was changing, which it was, so I guess something had to be done. We were all aware of things changing. And we had a wonderful guy doing the music, Jeff Smith, who later went to work for the BBC. And Jeff was very good at artfully working in the newer music with the stuff that we always played and allowing Chris to periodically play a little bit of Status Quo here, Guns N' Roses, all of those things that he loved. But we knew that there was a wind of change blowing. So I made a plan. And in that year, there weren't any job offers. I'd been offered a job at Talk Radio a couple of years before. And again, an untold story. And, you know, I have to apologise to the people involved in this. I've never done anything like this before or since. I was joining Talk Radio halfway through my time at Capital. And I'd left. I'd put in my resignation. And Richard phoned me after his Christmas holiday and said, "Oh, Howard, my office, 12 o'clock. I thought, I wonder what this is all about. He's probably going to kick me out early. He said, "Howard, take a seat. Would you like a herbal tea?" And there's the view from his office was on the sixth floor then, so I'm looking all the way out across Leicester Square. And he says, "Howard, you know I'm your friend." He said, "I don't think you're making the right move here." "Really?" I said, "Well, I'm under notice, Richard." He said, "Well," he said, "I wouldn't want you going there and then, you know, thinking I've done the wrong thing, because there's no coming back, you know." And I'd had a few misgivings. I thought, I wonder if this station is going to work that I'm going to. And I thought about it, and I actually decided I couldn't leave Capital. And, of course, my name was Mud at Talk Radio, quite rightly, and I'm sorry to those people, including Paul Robinson, who I let down. But I realised, as Richard said, "You see, how your story at Capital is not yet written." And he was right, of course. What was to come that year was the death of Princess Diana, which I was one of the people who broke to London and was a very impactful thing. 9/11, of course, I went to Ground Zero. A lot of things happened, and he was probably right. We went on an outside broadcast. It was to be the last one that we would all do together. We went to Tuscany, and our final hurrah was to be a few days in a villa in Tuscany. Now, Capital had sent out somebody who'd newly rejoined the company, a member of management. And I think now, as I look back on it, the point of it was to change Chris's mind. And indeed they did. And Chris later announced that he was staying for another year. They made a lot of concessions. He got a lot of holiday. Foxy did the breakfast show for a while. And I think they might have upped the money a bit, which I don't think was a factor in it. But my problem was that I'd left already. I'd been headhunted by Chrysalis. I was called to a meeting at the Pizza Hut in Leicester Square, and I was told, "We've bought LBC." You know, I loved LBC. "We've bought LBC, we're going to do American-style talk radio. We've increased the libel insurance, it's going to be everything you've always wanted." How could anybody say no to that? So I signed up. Only realising after I'd said goodbye to Capital, and boy was that a heart-rending leaving, I was on my way to Chrysalis to do breakfast news, essentially, and my own show at the weekend called Howard's World.
Alan, it's a pleasure to be with you in your home doing this broadcast. Tell me in your own words, better than I could sum it all up, you know, the story of how you came to hear about what happened on 9/11 and how you conveyed it to London.
Howard, what happened was that morning.
But
it was
LBC at Chrysalis was different when I joined. They ended up hiring a lot of ex-BBC people, so we went on air trying to be a commercial version of Five Live, and not the big, bold station that I was sold on. You know, I can understand the reasons why they did that. They probably thought, well, maybe that's a little too ambitious. But I went there. I did a year on the breakfast show with Jane Moore and John Nicholson, both of whom I liked very much. I don't think that breakfast show was quite right for LBC. And I remember going to the management one day. I had a meeting with somebody there. And I said, you know, breakfast is never going to work unless you put Nick Ferrari on it. So I did a year with Nick Ferrari, and they gave me a show before Nick, a news show that I produced and presented, but it took an hour of the Steve Allen show away. And I thought, I am going to get the backwash from this. Listeners are going to hate the Howard Hughes News Hour. So I think they had a lot of problems. I never really found out what they were. I think they didn't quite get the audiences that they were hoping to. And after 2 years, a bombshell for me, and I can talk about it now, it doesn't matter now, it's okay. A number of people, including myself, were dropped. I'd never been let go before. And this isn't meant to sound arrogant. You know, I just thought, I used to get offered jobs, not have jobs taken away. Bottom fell out of my world. And I thought, how am I going to... I've got 3 more months of this contract to go. I don't think I can manage to go on every day and keep smiling, knowing that I've just lost this thing. Meanwhile, Nick Ferrari was a great friend. He always used to come in and say, I don't have to do any prep because you've done it all for me. And we used to mess about on air and stuff. And I think the management didn't like it. I don't know. I've never known. And the only reason I was ever given for me being axed, what filtered back to me, I had an agent at that time. Nick Ferrari's a big personality. You're a big personality. We can't have 2 big personalities on The Breakfast Show. And you have to go. Now, what I should have done, if I'd been the person I am now, is I should have gone upstairs to Phil Riley, who ran Chrysalis and was a friend of mine from BRMB days, and just said, I understand this, Phil, but why has this happened and, you know, what am I going to do kind of thing? And I didn't. And I left on the Friday, and my final words were, in the Nick Ferrari show, LBC, it's 9:32. And I never reappeared. And it broke my heart. So the next thing that happens when I'm thinking the bottom has dropped out of my world, what the flip am I going to do? The phone goes, and it's Nick Ferrari. He said, I want you to know that I went straight up to management, and I said, and I quote, I told them, you have made a mistake. But it was too late. My fate was sealed. They told him it was part of the business plan, which I think it was. He said, okay, so that's it. He said, now, normally, there's nothing you can do in these situations, but I want to help you, quote. I said, I don't think, Nick, that's lovely of you, but what can you do? He said, you want me to phone Kelvin? And of course, Nick was big friends with Kelvin McKenzie because they worked together. Phones me back, says, Kelvin's going to call you. Kelvin McKenzie phones me. He was at TalkSport, running TalkSport, said, I've got a Saturday night here. What would you like to do with it? I emailed him 6 ideas, including a show about science, the paranormal, ghost space, all that sort of stuff. He phones me back to say, The Unexplained, that's the one I want you to do. So within a couple of days of leaving LBC, I had a gig on TalkSport, which was my mainstay for a little while. And then wonderful John Myers heard that I was around and offered me breakfast news on Jazz FM, which was becoming Smooth FM. So not only did I have one job then, I had two. John Myers was a fantastic friend and supporter in so many ways. He used to come into the office at Castle Ray Street, and he'd walk down the corridor, very narrow corridor, and bang me on the back with this great big hand. And I'd fly forward and he'd say, how's my star? So John was wonderful. You know, I managed to live again after LBC. Plus, I was into TV voiceovers then. British Comedy Awards, live. I'd done things like Silla's Moment of Truth. But I don't think my career was ever quite the same after that, sadly. And the one thing, of course, when something like that happens, you don't feel the same about that. You can't, you're not bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, goody-two-shoes anymore. You're always a little suspicious then. I had a period of working part-time in BBC local radio again, which was interesting, filled in for people like Tony Blackburn and Anne Diamond. If you're wondering who this is, Wittering, 622 Howard Hughes, BBC Radio Berkshire, Jonathan in Worthing. Nice to have you there, Jonathan. Worthing is wet. But, you know, BBC so local radio is... I can say this now because I don't think I'll be going back down the BBC local radio road, as many people are finding that they won't be either now, but I don't think it was really me. I was also working at the new talk radio from its very start, doing The Unexplained. They asked me to bring The Unexplained back. I do some voiceovers. I did the IRN Awards this year and that kind of stuff, really, whatever comes along. And of course, the podcast. Tomorrow, as we record this, I'm doing edition 500 of my podcast, which reaches people from Waterloo to Waikato in New Zealand. It's amazing. So, I'm still here. There are still things that I want to do, and I'm still enthusiastic about it, and I still, just like the 4-year-old kid who used to watch the telly, the test card, I still love it all. Oh, of course, there are always going to be regrets. Should I have left Capital? Well, I think probably, yes, it was the right thing to do. Should I have gone to the new LBC? Well, on the basis of what was offered, yes, I think so. Regrets. I suppose I think the big regret was not finding out properly what happened at Chrysalis, I think. John Myers did years later for me. It was his idea. I remember 3 months after going from there, I got a text from the producer of the Nick Ferrari show saying, you know that we're getting calls every day asking where Howard is. Now, that's not to say that lots of people hated me, loathed me on air. I'm sure they did. But, you know, that was nice to know. But the regret was that I didn't go and talk to somebody about it. You know, I just quietly went And I should have gone and had a grown-up conversation about what can we learn from this. I certainly haven't handled any of this perfectly. You've made career moves that have not been good. I've sometimes trusted people who I shouldn't have trusted. And I've sometimes failed to trust people who I should have. That's the truth of it all. So, you know, it's been a life with its downs and a life with its ups. But one of my teachers at school, I remember, Mrs. Farrer in Crosby, saying to me, "My daughter works for the BBC. If you want to go into broadcasting, you've got to take a lot of kicks in the teeth and come up smiling every time." Certainly during the Capital years, you know, you're in such a protected environment and you know, you think you're doing something special. I don't think I ever thought that I was special. Yeah, and when we moved to Leicester Square, we were trying to do the bulletins from the studio with the jock. You couldn't do the mixes and stuff like that. And so I did kick up a bit of a fuss about that, and Richard Park built me a £10,000 studio. Coming from where I came from, being what I am, I did the best I could, I think. I don't know how people are going to react to those words. I did the best that I could, always. You know, I hope that young people who came along, I helped them. Some people say that I did, and that I was, you know, influential in some ways. I had an assistant for years, you may have met her, Jenny Priestley, who was my assistant at Capital and also at LBC when I moved there. Jenny, I met because she was taking the cloakroom tickets at a Radio Academy event, and I was looking for somebody to be a helper to kind of book people for me to interview on Capital Breakfast News. And I said, what have you been? She said, "I've just been on this journalism course in Bournemouth, media course in Bournemouth." I said, "Would you like to do this?" And I gave her a one-week trial, and Jenny and I worked together for years. And Jenny always says, and it's nice of her because I'm very, very proud of what she's achieved. She's now running a media organization herself. But she always says that, you know, I gave her her start and I was her influence. So if I've done one good thing, that's it, really. That's it. My parents were very important to me. I'd like to think that they thought well of me because a lot of it I did for them. So, you know, I'd like to think of myself as having been somebody who at one time or another made his mum and dad proud. That's all I got.
Howard Hughes. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast. I'm David Lloyd, and if you do enjoy reminiscences, then grab my book. It's called Radio Moments. It's looking back through my own eyes at the last 50 years of radio, very personal perspective. That's Radio Moments, available on Amazon or from my website, radiomoments.com.